This is a Career Channel program from UC San Diego Extension. Visit us at www.uctv.tv/careers for videos, employment news, and trend articles to help recent college graduates and grads in career transition bridge to better employment.
Today on the inaugural episode of Career Talk, we visit with Neil Centuria, the CEO of Blackbird Ventures, an investor in high-growth potential companies. Neil also serves as CEO of Oberon Fuels, which is developing a clean alternative to diesel fuel. He and his wife, Barbara Bree, teach entrepreneurship at UC San Diego and write a weekly column for UT San Diego about entrepreneurship. Neil is also the author of a great book, I'm There For You, Baby, The Entrepreneur's Guide to the Galaxy, which is filled with valuable rules for entrepreneurs. He's been CEO of 6 technology companies, 3 in software, 1 in material science, 1 in media, and most recently, clean tech. So, Neil, let's start with your career path, because it's been diverse, to say the least.
Yeah, I don't recommend it for anybody else. I graduated with a degree in English shortly after the Civil War, and it doesn't really qualify you to do anything. So the era of the liberal arts education, I think, probably went out in my era. It was nice to have, and it was valuable in some ways in retrospect, but it's not a path you would normally take. I went to the movies. I wanted to write screenplays and direct films, which I did. I did that for 10 or 11 years. I was the second class at the American Film Institute, which is Beverly Hills, the Greystone Mansion. And then I moved to real estate. I found the movie business is the only business slightly worse than the movie business is used car salesmen and lawyers. So then there was some real estate for 12 or 13 years, and then technology. And what's interesting, though, is this. People say, well, how do you go from writing sitcoms to running a software company? And I'm going to tell you that some of the core principles of management or leadership, they go across any vertical. You, just because you learned how to run a plastic shop doesn't mean you can't run a subway or that you can't start a hat company. I mean, so but it's not a recommended path.
So you're one of those mysterious people called a venture capitalist. What exactly?
But I'm a small-time venture capitalist.
Oh, okay. Is that like a disorganized one?
Well, that means I'm short.
Okay.
Height challenge. Mm-hmm. Small-time means that I usually use my own money and some of my friends, but we don't have a fund. We're not a real venture capital fund. I mean, the funds in Silicon Valley are real funds. They raise $100 million, $500 million, $1 billion. They have limited partners. They have a half a dozen managers, and they have a clear path to investment. I'm more of a, I like an idea. I think I can add value. Maybe I'm the CEO for the first year or two, then replace myself. And the order of magnitude, we'll put in $500,000 and raise $500,000. So we're little guys. We'll put in $1 million plus or minus, and then we'll go look for the characters who have the other 5 or 6 or 10 million to grow the company. So I'm like a seed small-time venture angel investor,
A hybrid, a slash.
A slash.
So it's all of those. Well, let's talk the technology industry. What technology industry trends are you seeing these days?
I'm the wrong guy to ask, Henry. Normally I'd try to give you a great answer. I'm a big fan of yours. I'm not smart enough to tell you about technology trends. You got to read TechCrunch or SoCalTech or Tech Today, or I used to be a tech. I'm not much interested in trends. Now, what does interest me? I'm interested in really hard problems that are hard to solve, that are important if you solve them. And I'm willing to make those kind of risky bets. I'm a micro version of Vinod Khosla. Khosla is a famous VC in the Valley, Khosla Ventures. He was one of the founders of Sun Microsystems. And Khosla is only interested in home runs. He's interested, if you come to him and say, I've got it figured out and I'd like some money to grow that, he's not interested. I want to take something that can't be done and see if, now I'm not in his league. I mean, he's a billionaire. But I'm interested in really smart people, really hard problems, that if you solve it, it has some value. Not interested in apps. I barely know how. I have an iPhone. I've learned how to turn it on in the last month or two. I don't have an app that knows where I am. I don't want anybody else to know where I'm having restaurants. I don't tweet. I have a Facebook page, which Barbara, my wife, manages. So I'm not the right guy for technology. But I am interested in is backing really smart people who are willing to walk through walls and have technology or a passion to change the world.
Now, what about fuels? So certainly the diesel industry.
We took on something simple, which was to disintermediate the entire diesel transportation business. That seemed like a modest thing you could do in a couple of months.
A small project.
Yeah. What actually happened in Oberon is sort of classically entrepreneurial, and can be a long story, but I'm going to make it as short as I can. In the fall of 2010, man comes to my office and says, I've got something that's great. It takes methane and makes gasoline. It's a little bit like coal into diamonds. Wow. I can do it in a little bitty container the size of a toaster oven, and I'm going broke. I'm desperate. Will you save me? Sure. Throw my lifelines. I got a lot of those. So for a few dollars, we buy the patents, and it turns out the patents are worthless. You can't really make gasoline. It was an exercise in sheer incredible stupidity. Now, the point of the story, though, is this. After we come to the conclusion that we really have nothing, but we have one good idea, which is we're going to try to build small plants. If you're going to solve the problem of fuel, you have to make distributed. You have to have a gasoline station on every corner. Well, you can't just make one giant one unless you have a distribution system. So here's where entrepreneurs benefit from having smart advisors. There's a guy in Chicago, Ravi Randhawa. Ravi is the world leader in making small mini plants. We call him up. We say, look, well, I don't know, we're kind of screwed up. Would you come out? We fly him out. We have dinner at Trulux. Nice dinner. Ravi's a genius. The process, which is methane to syngas to methanol to DME to gasoline, that's the process. So Ravi says, Schmuck, why don't you stop at DME? It's a really interesting fuel. Oh. So what turned out, we then got DME, we got a large trucking company, we got approval from the state, we found a $1 billion oil and gas guy in Texas who wanted to rock and roll, we raised $100 million. I mean, we're launched because some guy said, gee, why don't you stop here? So I wasn't as smart as I thought I was. I mean, I actually had everything wrong until I found the right answer. That is common for an entrepreneur. The problem is not to start a company that you think you're going to do. It's to start a company that along the way you'll figure out what you really should be doing. Your customer will tell you. And the best part of the story is in January of 2012, we had $8,000 in the bank. And we should have been broke. And I asked the employees if they could have two choices. They could work for another month. We might pull a rabbit out of a hat. Or I'll fire you so that you can get unemployment. I'm a reasonable guy. They all voted. There was four of them. They voted to stay. And in that 30-day period, we pulled the rabbit, the hat, we got everything done, and we are now a really large company. Probably, this is a tiny bit arrogant, but there's discussion in a few years of going public. So you go from, all because of this guy walked in the office and said, look, I'm going broke, I'm desperate, can you save me? So that's an entrepreneurial story, but it's not unique. Everybody's story is like that. There's no clear path. If there was a clear path, it wouldn't be an entrepreneurial adventure.
Now, what's the biggest factor in your success through all the years in Hollywood, in real estate?
Well, you're kind, Henry. I don't know about the word success, but what I will tell you is this. This is one of the rules in the book. You know it. I know you read the book. Entrepreneurs don't do this for fame nor for fortune. They do it for revenge. Mm. So if you said, what's the biggest factor? I've been angry for the last 60 years. And I'm just now working through it. It's a little bit of you want to show your mother who thought you were. You want to show the music teacher. You want to show, look, Facebook was because he couldn't get laid with his girlfriend. I'll show you. He certainly did, by the way. He did really well at that. So I think things that motivate people are a combination of altruistic passion and good things. I mean, they want to change the world. And the other part is a bit of revenge, a bit of I'll show you. Even if you're not an angry person, it's, I want to show you that I'm able, it's Archimedes, I can tilt the world if I had a stick long enough and a place to stand. I'll show you.
Now, what about obstacles and challenges in your career? What were they and how did you overcome them?
Well, that was an easy question, wasn't it, Henry?
Sure, obstacles, it's easy to ask.
Obstacles. There's always obstacles. But I'll give you an answer to the obstacles, which is, and they're multiple. They're not, everybody's got different ones. Mine aren't anybody any special. The thing I find is this, the sort of relentless pursuit. I like that. Actually, I had a T-shirt made. I spoke at the Venture Group a few years ago, and I you know, I think they do at Petco, they throw T-shirts out to the stands. Well, I made a dozen T-shirts that said, and I stood up and I took off my coat, and on the front of it, it says relentless. And then I turned around, back of it says pursuit. And then I threw a dozen T-shirts to the crowd. By that, I mean, it's entrepreneurship in some ways is defined as follows. Somebody puts your head underwater and asks you to hold your breath for a minute. You say, I can do a minute, not a problem. And then at the minute, I'd like to come out. He says, no, we're not done yet. But no, you told me it was a minute. I said, no, you got to hold your breath another minute. I'm like, I didn't bargain for that. And so then they put your head down a little longer. Finally, you get to come up for some air, but then they put your head down below. So it's really about how long can you hold your breath? That's the nature. And what you find is you can hold your breath much longer than you think.
So it's persistence.
Yeah, coupled with insanity, I would argue that's probably reasonable.
Now, in your book, you have these great rules. Rule number 302, I was going to talk about that because that seems to be an obstacle. Rule 302, more money is lost through neurotic behavior than through bad business decisions.
You bet. I love that rule. I think if you look at companies, not just technology companies, look, you can look at the political scene. You can look at Heard at HP. You can look at Weiner, who was the senator or the congressman from New York. I mean, one of the things, when you read the story, you ask, what was he thinking? Or what was she thinking? The sentence is, what were they thinking? And the answer is, they weren't thinking at all. So what I find is, the characteristic that's most important to me and a CEO, I kid a little bit, but I actually believe this. I think if you want to be a CEO, you should have a minimum of 2 years of psychotherapy. 2 years. It's a little bit like getting an MBA. You got to get an MBA, and you need 2 years of psychotherapy because people act. Look, Kahneman's my favorite author. Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize 2002. He wrote the book Choices, Values, and Frames. He's brilliant. And he recently wrote another book called Thinking Slow and Fast. Kahneman's the master of rational man behavior. And what he proves is, by and large, here's the premise behind economics. Economics says people will act in their own best, watch, perceived self-interest. And I'm going to tell you the hardest part is perceived, because people don't really act in their best self-interests. I mean, if you're going to put at risk a $7 billion company and a $3.5 million salary because you're going to have an affair with a public relations person, what are you thinking? It's a little bit like Petraeus. I mean, it isn't always about sex. It's that I'm going to make an acquisition. Let's do autonomy. Let's do the HP. I'm going to buy Mike Lynch's company because the article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday says that whatever percent, 70, 80% of mergers and acquisitions don't work out. But they do it anyway because your is bigger because I acquired something. I got bigger, even if it makes no sense. So the issue of rational man behavior, in my judgment, is the single most important issue in backing a CEO. Are they really rational? If everybody says they are, trust me, Henry, they're not. And it's hard to do well. Kahneman ends his book, his newest book. He says, look, I've written about, Nobel Prize, and I still do stupid things. I mean, I'm the master of it, he says, his last paragraphs. I've trained. I've spent 50 years doing this, and I still find myself doing something stupid. It's hard to do, but it's hard. It's hard, but it's really important to get it right.
Let's talk about another rule. Rule number 31, no good deed goes unpunished. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a rule that's been, other people have said it. Let me turn the rule around a little bit. I think one of the other things that's important in a CEO, in an entrepreneurial adventure, is a highly defined sense of equity. Now, I don't mean ownership. I mean a sense of what's right and fair. Let me give you a perfect example. A young friend of mine, moderately related to me, is starting a company. And he's got two or three big shot consultants, advisors, who are willing to come on board and join the team. And they say, what is my deal? And he says, well, the deal is $5 and three options and something. And he said, they said, well, what about? And finally, here's the way you negotiate. You say, look, Betty Boop. You say, I'm willing to pay this for sure. And I'm willing, if certain things happen, to do more. And I can't tell you exactly what those things are because we've been in business 6 months. So you have to believe that I, the CEO, will act equitably, will not take advantage of you. And if you have that kind of ethics in your behavior as the CEO, you can get people who will trust you. Don't ever violate that trust. One of my favorite things is this. If I negotiate with an engineer, I say, I'd like you to join the company. It's $100,000 and 25,000 shares of stock. And I said, have you ever had stock? And he says, no. Do you understand what stock is? No. Do you understand what an option plan is? No. Do you understand about vesting? No. Then the obligation of the CEO is to say, look, stop. I have to negotiate for you. The obligation when you have 52 cards is you have to do better for them. Because I can beat your brains in 50 ways to Sunday. I do this for a living. I'm really good at it. But I choose deliberately, and I insist on other CEOs in my sort of mentoring and in the class, if you have the upper hand, you can't use it. It has to be a fair fight. I'm only interested in hard negotiation. I'm going to assume the other guy's reasonably smart and has a good lawyer. So I'll take the gloves off. I'm going to try to beat his brains in. But if I'm in a situation where I have the cards, you never take advantage. And that's how you build an ethics or an integrity in your company. So they talk about culture. Everybody wants to have a culture. I don't think it has anything to do with a ping pong table or a foosball table or one of those lamps that bubble, whatever those are called.
Lava lamps.
Yeah, lava lamps. I mean, that's bullshit. That's just not what we have.
Green M&Ms in the tray?
Yeah.
Okay.
Culture comes from the behavior and the integrity of the one or two managers who lead the company. If you act in a way that sets appropriate expectations of how you'll be treated and what is expected in return, you'll have a real company culture. But you can't buy it, and it's not like you can go out and get it. You can't just say, well, we're going to have a culture that's, you can't do that. It comes organically from the top.
One more question before we go to the questions from the listeners. Let's talk about career advice. What's the best career advice you've ever received?
I was hoping you'd ask. So here's a story. You know, we teach a class at UCSD in extension and entrepreneurship. Last class, last week, we go around and one of the guys says, look, I have a chance to work for Google and I have a chance to work at a startup. What should I do? And he says, I'm worried about the risk. He talks about the word risk. This is a fascinating word. So I look at him and I say, Mr. Jones, you're 26 years old, you have a PhD in computer science, and you are wickedly smart. So you will always have a job. So the risk is what you don't do, not what you do. You can get a job at Google, Microsoft, SAP, Oracle, and any other, Twitter, Facebook, in a heartbeat. So you don't have any risk. So the career advice was, if you can stand, now let's assume you don't have six children, you don't have a mortgage, you don't have your mother you have to take care of, you know, assuming you are semi-functional within a salary base of X, take a shot. The career advice is, you can't do that when you're 50. It's really hard. I mean, if you're going to do things that interest you greatly and have a perceived higher degree of risk, do them when you're young. Because if you're talented, which I'm going to assume your audience is 85% college graduates, I mean, these are smart people who are potentially listening to this. Why they're wasting their time listening to this is a whole other matter, but that's okay. Then the issue of career advice is, go ahead and take the risk, because what you perceive as a risk for guys like me who are 60, it's not a risk. You always will have a job. what you may miss out on is it's a little confused. It doesn't really have any money yet, but I'm employee number four and it happens to be Facebook, or it happens to be Microsoft, or that's exciting stuff. You can't, or Intuit. You can't, I mean, we're friends with Scott Cook. So there was a moment, of course, he seems like a good guy and it's interesting. That's career advice.
There you go. Well, let's take some questions from our listeners. First one is from Colin. He says, Neil, when you're hired at a startup, a tiny but growing company, how do you negotiate a salary in such a way as to be sensitive to the needs of the startup and yet still not roll over and just get taken advantage of by the company? What's your advice?
I'll give you some, that's a great question. First of all, if you're working at a startup that has an ethical CEO, he will figure out the right number. But remember this, you can't get paid retail. So if you want a job and the job pays 90, then if you want to work at a startup, they're going to pay you 75 and give you stock. Because the theory is that the value of what you're creating, the stock, the company, is 5 or 10 times greater than the $15,000 that you gave up for the salary. So, but it has to be semi-rational. Here's another way to do it for the guy. He says, look, it's a startup and he only wants to pay me $65,000 and I'm worth 90 and I really don't want to do that. That's too big a discount. I'm not there for you, baby. So you say, I'll tell you what I'll do, Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith is the CEO. I'll give you 90 days at that price. At the end of 90 days, I want a review. If I've blown the cover off the door, back we go to 90. CEOs will take that because I essentially get an option. I get a relatively free look. I'm thrilled. One of the things I do often is I'll say, I'll hire you somebody for 60 days. And it doesn't matter what the number is. At the end of 60 days, I'll renegotiate. I'll come to you and renegotiate because I want you to be happy. So one of the ways is for the employee, you know, it's okay if they beat their brains in for 90 days. You just can't beat your brains in for 3 years because at the end of 90 days, if you're good, what'll happen is you're now indispensable. You're irreplaceable. He or she says, I got to have this guy. And then the leverage has changed. You say, look, I'm entitled to a real salary and my options. And frankly, the CEO would be thrilled because he's already had a chance to see you perform.
So he has sampled the merchandise and likes it. Now, what about the downside? Let's say you don't perform in the 60 days.
Well, then it's hard to argue you're worth 90 grand, Henry. I mean, you know, give me a break.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's go to another one. And this is from Beth. Give us an example of a hurdle you sidestepped and would credit to your education. Something you learned at Tufts or along the way.
Well, I'll answer it this way. I think it's really important for the young entrepreneur to read the paper. I think it's critical, not just the blogs. You got to read the Wall Street Journal, New York Times. You got to read the New Yorker. You have to have a sense of the world. It's important to be. So I was educated, but I've continued to expand on it. My readings are not only computer science magazines. The fact that you might know something, I'd like breadth. I think there's a bit to be said for the Renaissance man, which somewhat is falling out of favor. Now let me answer the question on point. The thing that I measure for hiring somebody is, can you write? Can you write? And we have a system when I hire people, I'll know in 3 weeks if you can write. If you can't write, you can't work for me. I don't care how brilliant you are as a physicist or a mechanical engineer, if you can't write. Now, I'm not looking for, you know, War and Peace, but if I see an email or a letter that has misspellings or sentence structure that isn't good or well, that's a joke, Henry.
Yes, yes.
It's okay. Then you're not going to make it. So I put a big, big stamp on, and people talk about communications. Well, communications are vastly more than just verbal. I need to see that when you stand on for my company and you write a letter, now they call them, write an email, your contract work, got to be perfect. Do not send anything in that has misspellings. You get away with it because it's sent from my iPad and it's got a couple of misspellings. I'm okay with that. But if you're sitting at a computer with a keyboard and it's not spelled correctly with a sentence structure, subject, meta, predicate, verb, and a period, I don't always use periods, but I'd like to see them from other people. I don't use capital letters either, but you know what? I own the company, so I get a little dispensation. I have an affection for E.E. Cummings.
Now, going back to your rules, one of your rules, and it was so good in your class when you teach entrepreneurs, you stress this, is to show up everywhere.
Rule two, networking is a profession.
Yeah.
Become a professional at it. I can't tell you. What's fascinating to me is, you know, you make these rules up and they're really, really good. Sometimes I read the book and I say, you know, guys, what was he talking about? I will tell you that networking is absolutely critical. And I'm going to give you a perfect example. So, I mean, there's hundreds, but here's the most recent one. There's an event, one of those morning breakfasts, the Harvard Business School CEO Forum. There's 1,000 forums, whether it's Connect Forum, Harvard, you get their forums. And I go, and it's 7 in the morning. Give me a break. But you have to go. Well, sure enough, I meet somebody that is exactly in a job transition, and I'm in a hiring mode, and I grab this woman, and she is amazing, which I would not have found had I not gone. And the best story of all, Henry, is I wouldn't have been married to the most beautiful and charming and brilliant Barbara Bree. Everybody in town seems to know. It's not easy being married to an icon. Had I not gone to an event, October 7th, 1993, where it's raining and miserable, it's down at the Manchester Grand Hyatt. I'm sick and tired. I want to go home, but the rule is you have to go. I go, and my other rule is I never go in for the dinner. So I'll pay the money. I'll work the net. I'll work the cocktail hour. And then when they go in to eat for the awards, I'm out of there. I'm glad to pay. I just don't eat the salad.
That's the best advice for the whole show.
Right. I drive home. It's raining. It's miserable. And I realize something has happened after I've met Miss Bree. I am a professional room worker. That means that while I'm talking to you, I'm looking at Beth. I'm thinking about this. I got 5 people in my eyesight while I'm making, because I have to hit the room. I only got 47 minutes. And I realized as I'm driving home that I'd spent the entire 47 minutes only talking to Barbara Bree. And light bulb says, that tells you something. So I called her the next day and saw it. And it's been 20 years.
And the rest is history.
The rest is history.
And to quote Neil, you don't know if you don't go.
Right.
So you found out. Well, thank you, Neil. It's been a pleasure chatting with you today. And thanks for a great kickoff to Career Talk. I'd like to invite everybody to join us again for our next show. That's at 10:30 a.m., January 10th, 2013. We've got a new year. If the Mayans are incorrect, we'll be here next year. And that's going to feature Peter Kallstrom. He's the new CEO of the San Diego Workforce Partnership. That's an organization that funds job training programs. Again, that's the second Thursday of January, January 10th, 10:30 a.m. So thank you, and talk to you all next month. This is Henry DeVries, and until next time, wishing you career success.